the end of the last lecture, we discussed the significance of the fact that when you drive a quantum harmonic oscillator with a driving force, the harmonic oscillator will end up in a coherent state. So we assume that it started out in a ground state, you drive it, and it will end up in a state that is a coherent state. And we discussed that this means that electromagnetic excitations caused by such driving will be as classical as possible, because the uncertainty product is as small as possible. Now, have you thought about what the implications of that are if you carry it to the extreme? Let me just ask this. If any driving we do on a quantum harmonic oscillator has this feature that it leads to a coherent state, then aren't we stuck with that? How could we ever achieve that the electromagnetic field is not in a coherent state? I mean, what we just showed is that if you drive any which way you like, drive it softly, drive it strongly, whatever you do, at the end of it, it's going to be in a coherent state. So on one hand, this seems to indicate why it is that electromagnetic theory was initially conceived of as a classical theory by Maxwell and Faraday, even though it is a quantum theory to start with. It's all about fields, after all. And they didn't study the individual photons, they studied fields right from the beginning. But on the other hand, it begs the question, why then is it that, or is it not the case that sometimes the electromagnetic field is not in a coherent state? How can it happen? Any guesses?
Does it decohere when we don't drive it?
But decoherence and coherent state are different issues. Don't mix the...
Well, does it become kind of mixed, or...
Can you just leave it as it is? Well, coherent states are stable over time. Because you can view leaving it alone as applying a force, the zero force. So on its own, it will stay in a coherent state. Now, one thing you would imagine is that maybe if I make the resonance frequency of the harmonic oscillator time dependent, and we do not the driving through an external force, but we do the driving through parametric changes, then maybe that will get us in states other than coherent state. Turns out that's not the case. They too let us end up in coherent or more generally squeezed states. So is there any chance? How could we ever do it? Any guesses? Remember, there was one loophole. There was one assumption we had to make. As soon as we relax that, we're not going to have the coherent state. You see, one why did we say we end up with a coherent state? We end up with a coherent state because, and we will go through that in detail today in case you don't remember, because we find that the state that we end up with is an eigenstate of the annihilation operator A. And this is the definition of a coherent state. So it's an eigenstate with eigenvalue, with a finite eigenvalue. The ground state is an eigenstate to the annihilation operator with eigenvalue 0. It's annihilated by the annihilation operator. And the coherent state is an eigenstate to the annihilation operator with a different eigenvalue. And as we will see, the eigenvalue that we get for that coherent state is basically the J naught. Now, this integral over the driving force J. All we have to assume is that our driving force is not a classical force. See, if this is a quantum force, if you put a hat on that, it's no longer just number value. Then the integral over J of t that you obtain in order to calculate J naught, that integral is going to be an integral over an operator valued function, and J naught becomes an operator. Right? Now, just intuitively, you would have to go through the entire calculation. But it's clear that what plays the role of J naught can no longer be number value, no longer proportional to the identity operator. But J naught in this calculation that we will go through today will turn out to be the eigenvalue. Now, if J naught is no longer a number, it cannot be an eigenvalue. Right? So that means we won't get coherent states in that case. So as soon as we have quantum effects in the driving force, we're no longer driving it into a coherent state. So if, for example, this describes the electromagnetic field, and the driving force is charges and current, and those charges and currents have quantum features. If you have, for example, charges that are delocalized enough so that you can no longer describe them as classical particles moving, but you have to describe them as quantum wave packets, then their operators can no longer be approximated by number valued functions, by the expectation values, and so on. And then you shouldn't expect coherent states to come out of it. All right, just to remember, to remind you of what we had, the Hamiltonian has time-dependent operators because we work in the Heisenberg picture. This was the coupling term times the driving force. We solved that problem. We solved the dynamics here. And we found that at early times, when the force is absent, when J is zero, the Hamiltonian takes this form. And at intermediate times, while the force is acting, the Hamiltonian takes a more complicated form because A of t, our solution, took a more complicated form involving an integral over J. And then at late times, the Hamiltonian again takes a simple form if we express it in terms of A out and A out Zecker operators, where A out was A in plus J naught. Remember that the Hamiltonian at late times really looks a little bit more complicated in principle because you would have to, or you can if you want to, express A out in terms of A in. So then you have A in Zecker plus J naught star times A in plus J naught. So you get four terms out of this. This is really what happens to the Hamiltonian at late times. It becomes a little bit more complicated. It's just that when we introduce these operators A out, shifted A in operators, then we see that the Hamiltonian at late times again looks very simple. So our aim now is to calculate exactly what this coherent state is that the system will be in later. So remember that at early times, we diagonalized the Hamiltonian. Remember that the Hamiltonian at early times is time independent. This is just a fixed operator. And by using those operators A in, this operator A in, which with its adjoint obeys this commutation relation, we were able to construct a basis of the Hilbert space, an orthonormal basis, the Hilbert space, the Hilbert basis of the Hilbert space. We called this basis the set of vectors n in. They were eigenvectors to the Hamiltonian, to the early Hamiltonian, with eigenvalues en in. And those eigenvalues were omega, or really h bar omega, times n plus 1/2, but h bar we set equal to 1. And concretely, when you normalize those vectors, they can be written in this form. We apply the creation operator n times to the ground state, multiplied with 1 over square root of n factorial, and then that vector is normalized. I think it was an exercise to check that these things are really normalized. All you have to do for that to calculate this is write down the adjoint of that, which means you get a lot of ans over a ins over on the left-hand side, and a zero in bra. Then you use the commutation relations between the a and the a dagger until all the a's are acting on the right where they annihilate, and you get a lot of terms. You get 1 over n factorial, and everything cancels such that you're just left with the number 1. All right, so those n in vectors form a Hilbert basis, that is a complete orthonormal basis of the Hilbert space. Now, at late times, the Hamiltonian has become a different operator. It is this thing now, which you remember is really four terms, where this is really four terms if you express it in terms of the A in of them. And we can ask, well, this different Hamiltonian is self-adjoint again. If we just look at its shape, it's clear that it's self-adjoint again. It's going to have eigenvectors and eigenvalues. What happens to the eigenvalues? What happens to the eigenvectors and eigenvalues? Well, let us use those A out and A dagger out operators. Their commutation relations are these. Is it clear why they also obey these simple commutation relations? Any guesses?
How would you show that the A out and A out dagger obey these commutation relations? Because the A-ins do, and they differ from the A-in only by constants. The constants have the identity, that is, to be precise.
And that identity completely drops out of the commutator. So if you write here A-out in terms of as A-in plus J-naught, and here we write A-in dagger plus J-naught star, then the terms with the J-naught just drop out. We know that the commutator between A-in and A-in dagger is 1. So we get a 1 on the right side. So that means that we can go through the same procedure that we did at early times, and we can construct the eigenbases of the Hamiltonian at late. Just the same method. So there is again a unique vector 0 out in the Hilbert space, which is annihilated by the A out vector. And then we apply the A out dagger operator an arbitrary number of times on the zero out vector, namely here, put a normalization constant in front, and call the resulting vector N out. Then we can show that they are normalized and orthogonal to another. And one can show with some functional analytic methods that they actually form a Hilbert basis of the Hilbert space. Now, an interesting proposition is that the set of eigenvectors, a set of eigenvalues, is actually unchanged. If you look at the late Hamiltonian's action on the n-out eigenvectors, and let us call these eigenvalues en-out, then we find that the en out eigenvalues are omega n plus 1/2 again. And there's nothing mysterious about it. You can immediately calculate that simply from knowing what h looks like in terms of h out. And how does h out look like in terms of a dagger out and a out? You can immediately calculate that. And it's obvious, if you look at what you have to do, that you have to get the same eigenvalue. And that's because the Hamiltonian A out at the Hamiltonian at late times looks exactly like the Hamiltonian at early times. There's nothing different in the shape of it, except that in is replaced by out. So it's no wonder that you get the same eigenvalue. But of course, the eigenvectors will have changed. They have no reason to be the same vectors in the Hilbert space as the corresponding n-in vectors. And how exactly they are expressed in terms of another is the next topic. So here's a proposition that these vectors also form a Hilbert basis. That's just by the same logic as what we had at early time. Now, since we were able to find a Hilbert basis at early times and a Hilbert basis at late times, the following interpretation immediately applies. Consider late times. Then, if at late times the system is in the state n out, then it means that the system is in the nth energy eigenstate. If we were talking about quantum field theory, which is what we will do next, we will just translate everything into quantum field theory. But we can already anticipate that at late times, if the system is in that state, than it is in the nth eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. So it is n-fold excited, which in quantum field theory terms will mean n particles are present. However, remember that we work in the Heisenberg picture. So the state is not really evolving. Whatever Hilbert space vector was describing the state of the system at the beginning, it's going to describe it always. It's only the operators that change in time. So if, for example, the system starts out at early time in the state gamma, which may be, for example, the ground state at early times, then the system obviously always stays in the ground state of early times in that state gamma, a fixed Hilbert space vector in the Hilbert space. That's going to be the state of the system also at late times then. And we can expect that this state gamma, which was the ground state at early times, is not the ground state at late times. It's not that gamma changed. Gamma is always the same vector in the Hilbert space. It's always the state in which the system is in. No, what changed is which vector in the Hilbert space happens to be the ground state. At early times, this is the ground state. And at late times, that is the ground state of the Hamiltonian.
So that means that if gamma,
the state of the system, which at early times coincided with the ground state of the Hamiltonian, it means that gamma, it generically, should be expected to be some non-ground state, some excited state at late times. It doesn't mean that it has to be threefold or fivefold excited. It doesn't have to be an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. And in general, it won't be. But it won't be the ground state. So we expect excitation. In quantum field theoretical terms, we expect particle production. So what meaning does this state, which for simplicity we assume to be the ground state at early times, acquire at late times? To find that out, remember that the n-in form a Hilbert basis of the Hilbert space, as do the n-out, which means that I can express every vector in the Hilbert space in this basis with suitable coefficients, or in that basis with suitable coefficients. And in particular, each basis vector n-in is some linear combination of the basis vectors n-out, and vice versa. So in particular, there have got to exist coefficients lambda n, which express the vector that is the ground state of the system at early times as a linear combination of the Hilbert basis, Hilbert eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian at late times. That is a special example of a Bogle-Yubov transformation. So what is the meaning of those coefficients lambda n, which are the linear combination coefficients of the ground state at early times in terms of the ground state and excited states at late times? Remember that the system is frozen in the state gamma, which we chose to be the ground state at early times. And then assume we measure at a late time the energy. Let's say, assume we measure the Hamiltonian at late times. Late times, that's why there's the index out. Then we can ask, what is the probability amplitude for finding a particular energy eigenvalue E? Remember, measuring the energy operator, the Hamiltonian, means finding an eigenvalue of it. And which eigenvalue we find is probabilistic. And we can ask, what's the probability for finding a particular energy eigenvalue after the force has finished acting? Now, clearly, the probability amplitude for finding the state n out, the n-fold excited state at late times, if the system started out in the state gamma, which was the ground state initially, is simply the bracket between the n-out state that we are looking for and the state gamma that we know the system is prepared in. I'm going in a lot of detail through this just to train you to think in Heisenberg picture terms, okay? Because there's no time evolution in any of this, okay? Do you see that? Time evolution is encoded in the fact that the n out are different vectors from the n in, okay? Which means that the probability for finding the nth eigenvalue, the nth energy eigenvalue, the probability for finding the system in the nth excited state at late times, knowing that it started out in the ground state, is given by this modulus squared. So that is what the lambda n means. Namely, they give us directly those numbers. See, in order to calculate the bracket between the state that we're looking for at late times and the state that we know the system is in, it's the bracket between n out and zero in, because that is what gamma is. Zero in, we can express using the Bogoliubov transform as a linear combination of those lambda n times the m out. And you see, the n out and the m out are orthogonal to another, except if n is equal to m, in which case it kicks in that they're normalized. And then we just, at the end of the day, we simply pick out the coefficient lambda n. So lambda n is the probability amplitude for finding the harmonic oscillator in the nth excited state at late time if it started out in the ground state. And therefore, the probability for finding the harmonic oscillator in the nth excited state at late time is lambda n modulus squared. In quantum field theory, the corresponding coefficient will be the probability for finding n particles if we started out in the vacuum. But of course, so far, we'd only gave a name to this coefficient. We said that any vector in the Hilbert space, including this one, must have an expansion in terms of this Hilbert basis. And these are the expansion coefficients. Now, we should be able to figure out what they are, those expansion coefficients. So we actually calculate that Bogoliubov transform. OK, so how do we calculate the lambda n? Let's do it the mathematician's way. We give the solution and then prove that it's right. In this case, it's actually easier to do it this way. You could also derive it, but it would be a little bit tedious. So the claim is that the lambda n are up to an overall normalization coefficient that doesn't depend on n, given by 1 over square root of n factorial, j naught to the power n. Is there anything one can read off from that proposition before we go proving it? Can we tell anything about the overall behavior of the lambdas in this way, and therefore of the probability for finding highly excited states? What happens if we let n go to infinity? If we go to very, very high excitation? So we ask, what's the probability for finding the harmonic oscillator in the gazillions excited state after the force is active? Does this probability go up or down as we increase n?
How do you see that? Is it the n factorial will probably beat out the j naught?
Right, and how do you know that?
Because factorials go up really fast.
Yeah, it's pretty much Stirling's formula. Okay, the factorial has an e to the power n, or e to the power minus n actually, which doesn't look very good for its large n increase, but it also has a term n to the power n. In this case, n to the power n half, because of the square root. But that's, of course, growing much faster than anything to the power n. And so therefore, this thing will actually be and better shown, because after all, the sum of the squares of those, the sum of the moduli squared of those is 1. It's 1. Because it's the normalization of zero in, right?
Yes.
Again. Right, so here's a vector, and here are its coefficients in an orthonormal basis. So therefore, the norm of that vector can also be expressed as the sum of the modulus square of those numbers.
they have to sum up to 1.
And it will be an exercise for you to verify that these things really sum up to 1. Namely, to show that this is really a normalized vector. Okay, so the claim is that the lambda n are those coefficients. Which is to say that the claim is that the zero in vector is a linear combination of the n out bases with those coefficients. And that's the claim. So what do we have to show? Well, we have to show that this thing is really the zero in vector. How can we identify the zero in vector? Well, we can identify the zero in vector by its key defining property, namely that it's annihilated by the A in operator. So all we have to show is that the A in operator annihilates zero in. We know that this is true, but it's not trivial to show that when you apply A in to the right hand side, this is really zero. For that, this really has to be correct. Now, of course, it's always only unique up to a constant phase that you can put in front of any eigenvector. Any eigenvector stays an eigenvector if you multiply it with some phase, and it stays normalized too. So this is not the unique answer. You can always multiply it with a phase, a complex number of modulus 1. And that will not change our predictions for the probabilities for finding any one of these added states, because the phase is not going to change the modulus of the overall thing, and it's the modulus that gives the modulus squared that gives us the probability for finding an excited state. Okay, so in order to prove that this is really the correct Hilbert transform, we need to apply A in on that thing and show that we get zero. But on the right hand side, we have an out operator, an out vectors. So it's not so convenient to apply A in on it. But that's not a big problem. We know how the A in and the A out are related. So instead of applying A in directly on that vector, we can also apply A in expressed in terms of A out. So we express A in as A out minus J naught and apply that to this vector. So we are showing, instead of this, we are showing that A out minus J naught applied to this candidate zero in is equal to zero. Okay, so we show we need to evaluate whether it's A out minus J naught acting on this supposed zero in vector. And here comes now a very typical calculation in this business, except in the sort of thing that we need to do also. But whenever you do probably with transforms, be it in condensed matter physics or cosmology. First of all, we need this A out operator to act on something. And it's not so obvious exactly what it does when it acts on an N out. You can work that out, of course, but it's easier not to have to do that as a separate calculation, but instead, we simply write the n out operator explicitly in all detail, the way it was defined. N out, if you remember, was defined as this thing. N out is the vector that you obtain by applying a dagger out n times to the ground state, zero out, and then multiply it with this normalization factor. If we do that, those two square roots combined to give you full power, 1 over n factorial. And in front, we haven't done anything yet. This is simply carried forward from here. Okay? Now, this 1 over n factorial here can be combined with this a dagger to the power n to give us an exponential. Right? Remember the exponential series. So we can write this as e to the power j naught a dagger out. That's all of this acting on zero out. And this again is just carried forward. Now, that bracket contains an operator, but it can be commuted with that expression because it's just a number. So that gives us clear. Now, at this point, our strategy has to be to try to move this A operator so far to the right that it acts on the zero out, because then we can get rid of it. Every term that contains an A out acting on the zero out is vanishing, because A out acting on zero out is the zero, the zero rate. So what we do is we try to commute the A out through this exponential and see what terms we pick up. For that purpose, we remember the commutation link between A out and A dagger out. From those, one can prove, and I need to use an exercise to prove this, that the commutator between A out and the exponential J naught A out dagger is simply bringing down J naught, and then you have e to the power J naught A dagger out. Is that plausible to you, why you would get that? Does that look likely, that this is the outcome when you calculate that? Commutator between A out and e to the power j naught A dagger out. Is that?
Well, you could calculate the commutator between A out and A dagger out raised to the power n, and then you could write the exponential.
That's right. That's how you would prove it. That's right. That's how you would prove it. You write the exponential again as a power series, and then figure out how A out commutes with A dagger to the power of r. And then you do that and put it all together as an exponential series at the end. Exactly. That's how you would go about proving. But there's also a shortcut that you may want to see. Remember that when you have A dagger, you have A dagger minus A dagger A equal 1, that this looks very similar to dx x minus x dx equal 1. Okay? Are you familiar with this being true?
Huh? Okay, let's see. We have dx, okay,
let's just apply it to a function, right? Because as it stands, it has nothing to act on. But let's apply that to a function, minus x dx minus 1 f of x. Okay. Then what do we have? Well, we have dx, let me just write it out completely in detail, minus x dx f of x minus f of x. Okay? Then what is this? This is a product rule. So you get it's f of x plus x dx f of x minus x dx f of x minus f of x. Okay? Which is here. What I just showed you is that the Leibniz rule is sufficient to evaluate derivatives on any functions that can be written as power series. Because if the function f is a power series in x, then you can do what you just discussed. You can commute the dx's through the powers of x using these commutation relations, and you will find the correct answer for the derivative. So taking that intuition over here, you see what's going on here is that the commutator between A out and this is like the derivative acting on a function which has a power of x over it. So the A dagger plays the role of the x, the A plays the role of d by dx, and you see that this is basically the derivative that we get. And that's what it should give us. It should give us W J naught, the coefficient of the exponential. We get that. So in the future, if you have to evaluate the commutator of A with anything of A dagger, you know that it's got to be the derivative with respect to A dagger. Okay? Just like in this case. All right, so now using this, using the fact that the commutator between A and the power of A dagger is this, we can rewrite that line. We can rewrite A acting on that in such a way that we have this expression with A on the right-hand side, but that term goes away. So in this commutator, the term where the A is on the right-hand side will drop out because it acts on the zero out. And then we are left with two terms. We are left with the term where we are left with this term and with the J naught term. So we are left with the term where we have J naught times that, that replaces this thing here, so we get J naught minus J naught. We have those two terms, we carry that one forward. This one just turns into a J naught times that, like this. And the term where the A is on the right hand side is here, and as we discussed, it drops out because A is acting. So therefore, everything here cancels out, and we have zero, meaning that A in, acting on this supposed zero in state, is really vanishing, which is to say that this really was the zero in state, possibly up to a normalization factor. But I leave it up to you to show that this normalization factor is really right. That this is really, that you need no further factor in front of it, that this is already normalized. So for that purpose, you need to show that 0n is 1.
And it's just a matter of working a little bit with those a's and a dagger. So now we've shown that if a harmonic oscillator is prepared in that vector of the Hilbert space, which at early times is the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, then after the driving force has ended, the state that our system is in still is in, because the state doesn't change, of course, is now an eigenstate to the A out operator with eigenvalue J naught. Remember where this is from? This is the equation, right? So this is the state in which our system is in. This is what we call gamma. And so what we showed just now is that A out acting on gamma gives us J naught times gamma. So J naught is the eigenvalue of A out for this eigenvector. And for that reason, we say that that gamma is a coherent state. Because it, we say that because it is an eigenvector to an annihilation operator with a finite eigenvalue. And now coming back to what I said at the beginning of the hour, when you have a driving force that has to be described in operator value terms, if it's not a classical force, then the integral over it, which gives us J naught, also gives us something operator value. So this can no longer be read as an equation describing an eigenvector to an eigenvalue. And we don't have a coherent state in.
Obvious to me that an eigen state of the A will have the property of being saturated E.
Yeah, it's not the principle.
Is that non-trivial to show, or?
Not hard to show. I
was considering to put in another slide or two to do this. But what you need to do basically is, maybe there's a shorter way to do it, but you basically go through the derivation of how you get the uncertainty principle. And if you look at how that works, you see that linear combinations of X and IP come up. They are basically the A and the A dagger. And so what is normally the inequality on the right-hand side becomes saturated because you actually have the operator A. You can identify the operator A in there, and you know that the eigenvalues, that there's an eigenvector with some eigenvalue, and therefore you can shortcut that derivation of the uncertainty principle and find that it saturates. But I thought it's really just quantum mechanics. And so I think we should spend more time on the quantum field theory, and we're spending too much time on the quantum mechanics anyway. No, it's not obvious, but it doesn't take very long either. So if you look up one of the better books, one of the more detailed books on quantum mechanics, it should have that. Standard. So now in quantum field theory, how does all of that look like? Just a matter of translation, really. Remember that the Hamiltonian now looks like this, where this is a driving force that comes, for example, from other fields. For example, classical currents and charges. If this is the electromagnetic field, or a simplified version of it, then the interpretation now, it could be that, as I said, the phi hat could be a simplified version of the electromagnetic field, and J could be a simplified version of classical currents and charges over here. And what we are, we are simplifying in two crucial ways here. One is that we are dropping the vector character of the electromagnetic field, and we are dropping the quantum character of the charges and currents. And if we do that, then if we look at the in and out periods, the periods before and after the charges and currents were acting, then what do we obtain? So we have charges and currents that are vanishing for all times outside the interval from 0 to capital T. We know from what we've just calculated that it suffices to look at the early period and the late period and to relate the bases to another, to another, the eigenbases of the Hamiltonians to another for the individual modes. And remember that at early times, we're dealing with a free quantum field theory that has no driving in it. And at late times, we're dealing with a free quantum field theory without driving too. So let us look at the free undriven quantum field theory at early times. And let's put it in terms of those variables that we used for the harmonic oscillator. So at early times, it looks like that, the Hamiltonian, without any driving forces. We need to solve three things. As always in quantum field theory, we need to solve three types of equations. We need to get the hermeticity right, the commutation relations right, and the equations of motion right. So we have to have the Klein-Gordon equation and the commutation relations, and those guys have to be self-adjoint, the phi hat and the pi hat. As we discussed quite a while ago already, we fully transform them and obtain the phi hat k fields. If we do that with an infrared cutoff, then the k take only discrete vector value. After the Fourier transform, the equation of motion decouples into an infinite set of individual uncoupled harmonic oscillator equations of this form. Remember that those things are not self-adjoint, therefore they're not quite ordinary harmonic oscillators. But as we showed by working in the Schrödinger picture of quantum field theory, it is okay. You can just neglect that and work as if it were harmonic oscillators, only that they have complex amplitudes. Well, and we have to solve this commutation relation, which has this odd feature that it's not k, it's not peaking when k is equal to k prime, but when it's k, when k is equal to minus k prime. Because if you put a dagger here, you get a minus sign there. So the true canonical conjugate to phi hat k is really pi hat dagger k. yeah. And then if we fully transform back into the space coordinate, we find that phi hat and phi hat are zero. Now, in order to solve this, the Klein-Gordon equation, we did originally introduce variables q and p at each point, which were individual harmonic oscillators. For every mode, a harmonic oscillator. In essence, we are doing here, not in essence, we are really going to do here now exactly the same thing again, except we won't write it out again in terms of the q's and the p's at each harmonic oscillator value k. But instead, we use directly the q plus ip, which are the a, and then the q minus ip would be the a dagger. So if you want to go back to the q's and p's that we introduced for each field harmonic oscillator, easy to do that. Just take the A and A dagger, take the real part, get the Q, take the, oh, no, this is not really the server joint part, take the anti-server joint part, get the P. So in quantum mechanics, we had the Q and the P operator. And also in quantum field theory, we had Q and P operators. But they are different ones. These are the Q and the P operators of our quantum mechanics consideration of the first part of this lecture today. These are not the Q's and the P's of the harmonic oscillator modes that we described. And in quantum field theory, we define the AK operators to be those things, which you can then decompose again into Q's and P's. And they are linearly related to the Q's and the P's that we defined earlier. Now, the equation of motion and the canonical commutation relation in ordinary quantum mechanics are those for the free harmonic oscillator. This is the equation of motion. And in quantum field theory, that is the equation of motion that we obtained for the field mode oscillators, for those AK of T. This is the equation of motion with that commutator here. Remember that this is the proper delta on the right-hand side, k minus k prime. So it's just the usual kind of commutation relation between a and a dagger. It's only phi of k and pi of k that have unusual commutation relations. Now, the important thing I want to stress is that this is the Klein-Gordon equation only if there's no force acting, the free harmonic oscillator, and if omega is also time independent. Now, we solved it just to say this for quantum field theory just the same way that we did for quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, the time evolution at early times, simply this phase factor times A in, where this is a constant operator. And in quantum field theory, again, for each mode, at every point in momentum space K, for every mode we have that this is its time evolution, where this A in x K is a constant operator, doesn't involve in time, all the time dependency simply in this space. Now, explicitly, this means that we can express the original variables, time evolution completely. In quantum mechanics, we can write Q as the self-adjoint part of A in, which means it's A in plus A in dagger. All of the time evolution sticks in here. And in quantum field theory, we can do just the same thing. We can write the
phi hat now as a self-adjoint part of A in K in this way. And fundamentally, we have lots of those oscillators, and the Fourier transform gets us back into position space. So that means that we obtain the full solution in the position space, which is that. Only taking that and Fourier transform. So you have really e to the power I kx.
Sorry, going back a bit, once we did the infrared approximation, so we had a discrete set of k values. Wasn't the point of that so that we had a Kronecker delta and not a Dirac delta? So why are you using Dirac deltas again?
That's right. I think, yeah, maybe. Well, are you talking about the slide before?
Before, too.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's right. That's right. I haven't implemented the infrared cutoff at that point. So it's still.
So.
Yes, so it's a Dirac delta.
Okay, fine. So we haven't done it yet.
No. And that's right. And you can also tell that we haven't done the infrared cutoff yet by the fact that the Fourier transform comes with a factor of 1 over 2 pi to the power 3 half rather than 1 over L to the power 3 half, which comes to the box size. But now we can introduce the Hilbert space of states, which is very similar to what we did in quantum mechanics, except that we have many more oscillators to deal with. So we have all those ATMK annihilation operators that act on that Hilbert space vector 0 in. So we should really think of zero of having. What we have is infinitely many harmonic oscillators. For every k vector, or even every point in k space, if you don't have infrared cutoff, but it's better to think of it as having an infrared cutoff. For every k vector, we have an individual harmonic oscillator, which has its ground state, and which has its eigenbases. And the eigenbases of the full tensor space of all those harmonic oscillators is the tensor product of, consists of the tensor product of all those vectors. So in principle, what the zero in is really zero in for one value of k, let's call it k1, tensor product with zero in of another harmonic oscillator, tensor product with, and so on. In principle, it's an infinite tensor product, but it's all subsumed in this definition here. Now, mathematically, this is opening up a can of worms, because in the case where we have an infrared cutoff, we have already an infinite tensor product of vectors, which in itself harbors some difficulty. But if we don't do an infrared cutoff, then we have an uncountable number of tensor products to take, which is really, you shouldn't do that. shouldn't do this. But even if you just had a countable number of vectors, strange things can happen. For example, if you take a vector alpha, which is normalized, and the vector beta, which is normalized, and their bracket is, I don't know, 0.3, for example, to keep things simple, so they have a certain angle to another, then you might think, well, I want to calculate what the inner product is between this vector, where I put all the harmonic oscillators in the same state, alpha. Let's say they are all in that alpha state, and I know that, and I'm asking what's the probability for finding them all in the beta state. Okay? strange thing is that if your tensor product goes on to infinity, if you have infinitely many of those, then if you call this state phi and this state psi, then what you obtain is that the bracket of psi and phi is what?
Zero.
Okay? So it looks as if this state is orthogonal to that. Okay? And you can get a lot of problems of that kind, even if you have an infrared cutoff. Just want to say that functional analysis becomes funny if you do too many tensor products, if it's infinitely many of them. But we will see that there are more problems here. Well, this is not necessarily that much of a problem. You can always fix this by saying, no, I have only a finite number of tensor products. It may be tremendously large, could be a gazillion, but it's a finite number. That could fix the problem. I mean, just to make sure that you got what the problem is. The problem is that any two vectors, okay, any two vectors that have any angle to another would be orthogonal when you take lots of them here, right? Any two, because any number that is not one, any bracket that has modulus smaller than one will turn into zero by this procedure. So you can fix this by saying, yeah, but we don't have all possible k values. Very, very, very large values of the k vector are eliminated from the theory. You're saying that no, not arbitrarily large k vectors can occur. Now, large k vectors correspond to small wavelengths. Therefore, a cutoff on the existence of large k vectors is what is called a short wavelength cutoff or ultraviolet cutoff, as opposed to infrared, which stands for longer than visible wavelength. Ultraviolet stands for shorter than visible wavelength. So an ultraviolet cutoff will fix this problem. But we will see, we will have more problems that require cutoffs. So the Hamiltonian reads at early times like that. Remember, no force present. This is simply writing it in Fourier space. Now, if we express it in terms of the A and A dagger operators, A and A dagger in operators, then we get this expression here, where we have a delta 3 of 0 from the commutation relative between A dagger and A. If we do the infrared cutoff, then the Hamiltonian of the individual harmonic oscillator is omega A dagger A plus 1/2. But if we do not do the infrared cutoff, then the commutation relations are not a chronic, have not a chronic delta, but a Dirac delta, and then we have a Dirac delta here. It would be really bad because it means we are adding an infinity here if we want to take the Dirac delta seriously. So that would be bad. It would be an infrared divergence. That this thing is infinite is infrared divergence, because if we put the system in a box, this Dirac delta turns into a Kronecker delta. So it becomes finite. So with an infrared cutoff, each individual term here in the sum that we obtain when we put it all in a box, so here we're integrating over all k values, we're putting it in a box, so we're summing over all k values, and then each term in the sum becomes finite. It's finite, but we are still summing infinitely many of them, right? There's something infinitely many of them, and so we get an infinite sum for each value of the k vectors. For each k vector, we get a contribution omega k times 1/2, or just 1/2, with an infrared cutoff, and that adds up to an infinity. It adds up to infinitely much energy in the Hamiltonian, and that is what is called the ultraviolet catastrophe of modern-day quantum field theory, that this is infinite. Now, we already discussed the possibility of an ultraviolet cutoff. at the right cutoff means we assume that there are not arbitrarily large k vectors in nature. We can't have arbitrarily large excitations of those small oscillators. We can't put an arbitrarily large amount of energy in there. After all, if you excite just one of them too much, would have to form a black hole. And it's just, there's a limit to how much you can, how much energy you have available. Of course, in individual mode, it's completely delocalized. But if you wrote down a wave packet with too much energy in it, it would form a black hole. So if you put an ultraviolet cutoff as well, so you're saying that the k values, the k vectors cannot have a length larger than such and such, so wavelengths cannot be shorter than so and so, then this becomes finite. Well, this contribution becomes finite. And we will discuss that later on a little bit more, but let me just indicate what that, what the cutoff usually is taken to be. Cutoff is usually taken to be the Planck length, no wavelength shorter than the Planck length. You can translate that into a largest value of the k vector, integrate this up, or really sum it all up, and find out what the energy density would be in this case. What is the ground state energy density? Each harmonic oscillator contributes its ground state energy. It's 1/2 h bar omega. How much is that? What's the energy density? And it turns out it's too big. It's by 120 orders of magnitude bigger than what is observed as the vacuum energy. Okay. I suppose you have all heard of that problem. And we will have to come back to that, of course. All right, now, enough of the ground state. What if we want to specify multi-particle state? Well, we can do that. For example, how would we write down a state in which we know that we have two particles of momentum k and seven particles of momentum k prime, k prime being vectors of momentum. All we have to do is have to apply the a dagger operator for k prime 7 times, multiply with 1 over 7, square root of 7 factorial, do a similar thing for creating two particles of momentum k. And that state is going to be normalized, and we're going to be sure that we have two particles of momentum k and 7 particles of momentum k prime. What if we wrote down a linear combination of applying a dagger 7 times from 0 in plus applying a dagger in k 2 times on 0 in? What would that state be? Would that have the same meaning? You see what I mean? If you broke out this thing, okay,
then you get a certain vector. Add to it the vector that you get by blocking out that thing. Isn't that a state in which you have two particles of momentum k and seven particles of momentum k prime? No, it's not. But that would be the state in which you either have two particles of momentum k or seven particles of momentum k prime with certain relative probabilities depending on what the prefactors are for the first vector and for the second vector. So this is the vector that describes the presence of those particles together. Right, now after the force acted, or after the currents acted on the electromagnetic field, we obtain that the annihilation operator as a function of time can be written in this way, just by complete analogy with the quantum mechanical harmonic oscillator. Where A out is A in plus J naught, and now we have a J, one J naught for each momentum K. One can construct the out basis, the eigenbasis of the harmonic oscillator at late time, the mode harmonic oscillators at late time. And then one can express the in state, the in vacuum, as a linear combination of the out basis. And this then tells us how many particles of momentum k were produced by the driving force, for example, by the antenna. let's just give you a short preview of what's coming up. We will, of course, also discuss case B, where the harmonic oscillator is driven not by an external force, but by a time dependence of its parameters. So assume now that the harmonic oscillator of the mode has this form. There's a time dependence in its frequency. This is after Fourier transform. Then we will try an ansatz for the solution which separates the three problems that need to be solved. Remember, the three problems in quantum field theory are always: make sure that your operators, that your fields are self-adjoint operator valued, the commutation relations, and the equations of motion. It's very hard to write down a solution right away that solves everything. So it is strategically a good idea to write down an ansatz which has different components, each of which in isolation either take care of the commutation relation or the equation of motion or the hermeticity. And this ansatz is going to do this. So we try to find the solution to our quantum field theoretical problem, phi hat of t, which has the right hermeticity properties, commutator relation, and equation of motion. First of all, by writing it down in this way, we are making sure right away that the hermeticity properties are right, because this thing here, see, a function of time times this operator here, is the Hermitian conjugate of that with a minus sign. Okay? So that means that if we take the dagger of that, we get phi hat of minus k, okay? Which is what we have to have. Because if phi hat of x is self-adjoint, phi hat index k has to have the property that phi hat dagger k has to be phi hat minus k. Okay? And the Fourier transform, this means that phi hat of x and t is equal to under Fourier transform. Okay, so by writing down an ansatz for the solution in this way, we make sure that we get the hermeticity property, this one, right away. In fact, because we know we have to have that in the solution, we know that the solution has to, we have to be able to write the solution in this way. It has to be decomposable in this way. And then let's look at those individual terms. This is a function of time. That is an operator that's constant in time. So this thing does not help us in solving the commutation relations. It can just number that. But it can help us solve the equations of motion because it's time dependent. This thing, on the other hand, is not going to help us in solving the equation of motion because it's constant in time. But it's an operator. It can help us solve the equation, the commutation relation. And these are the only two things that are left to solve, commutation relations and equation of motion. So as a general strategy, this is always a good idea. Solve those two issues. Write the solution as some function of time, which is supposed to take care of the equations of motion times an operator that's supposed to take care of the commutation. As I said, the ansatz already guarantees that the hermeticity conditions come out right. And we use A and A dagger operators that obey these usual commutation relations. And if you put it all in a box, we require that this is a Kronecker delta. And then we ask that the vk take care of the rest. So the vk of t needs to be such that phi k of t obeys the right commutation relations and the right equations of motion. And the proposition is that this ansatz, this one, this ansatz here, is going to work if the mode function vk solves the equation of motion. So notice that this is no longer the Tangordan equation for the operator valued field phi hat. This is the equation of motion for this so-called mode function v. Okay. The claim is that if the mode function v obeys the Kangorden equation and obeys this strange equation down here that we will encounter quite a bit in the future, the so-called Wronskian condition, then we have a solution to our problem. In the case where the harmonic oscillator is driven not by external forces, but parametrically. Now, how is that coming about? Well, first of all, if our mode function obeys the Klein-Gordon equation with time dependence, and remember that this is just a number value function, this is an ordinary differential equation. We should be able to solve that, at the very least numerically. Well, if v obeys the Klein-Gordon equation, then it's easy to see that phi hat is obeying the Klein-Gordon equation. That's simply because the Klein-Gordon equation is linear. So if this is obeying the Klein-Gordon equation, and that is obeying the Klein-Gordon equation, the Klein-Gordon equation is real. So it's, you take a solution and it's complex conjugate, they both obey the equation of motion. The Klein-Gordon equation. So this obeys the Klein-Gordon equation, that obeys the Klein-Gordon equation, and these things are just constants. They're operator valued, but constants. So they can be pulled out of the Klein-Gordon equation. Therefore, if those guys obey the Klein-Gordon equation, this will obey the Klein-Gordon equation. The only thing we have to check is that the phi hat and its time derivative, which is to say phi hat, obey the right commutation relation. And that is what this Wronskian condition takes care of. Let's quickly check this. So we have to check the commutation relation between phi hat and pi hat. That is to say, between phi hat and phi hat dot. Phi hat is this. Phi hat dot is the same thing, but with dots over the v's. And I'm sorry, I have to put a star here. Okay. But that also comes down. Let's see. So we have to come. We have to commute these through those. Now the A dagger doesn't care about that A dagger, but it will care about the A over here. That will give us a term B minus K B dot K. That's this term. It comes with the minus sign because we have an A dagger here and an A there. Commutator has a plus sign if you have A dagger. Here we have A dagger A. And then we have this A getting caught up with that A dagger here, and that gives us a V star and a V dot. And here we need a star.
Yes.
So this expression here, 1/2 times that, better be I times delta. So we will achieve that the commutation relations come out right if this expression here in this mode function is 2i. Because then the 2 cancels that, the I is left over and gives us that thing over here. So I leave it to you as an exercise to show that the solutions that we have dealt with so far are the special case where omega is constant. Then you can go through the same arguments and apply them in the case where the frequency is not actually changing over time. And then you find that it's true. And then you deal with the question, what is, how large is the set of solutions of Vk? How many solutions can you find for the K differential equation for the equations of motion, at least for the Kangorian equation, and for the Wronskian condition. How many solutions are there? How big is the parameter space of solutions? Because it's not going to be unique. And it's important that it's not going to be unique. So we are going to find a solution to our dynamical problem whenever we find a mode function V which obeys the Kangorian equation and the Wronskian condition. But what do we make of the ambiguity in this? Because there's not just going to be one solution, there's going to be several. It's a multi-parameter family of solution problems. And as you will see, there are going to be Bogoliubov transforms that get us from one to the other, so on. Okay, any questions? No? All right, so then till Thursday. You all received the email about there not being any classes on English.